Hello there. My name is Marshall Latham, and I'm the host and founder of the Journey Into podcast. And I'd like to tell you about my Kickstarter project. For many, many years, I have enjoyed the works of Edgar Allan Poe. Poe was one of the first American authors who attempted to make a living at writing short fiction. In doing so, he practically became the inventor of several of the genres of speculative fiction that we enjoy today. He's mostly known for such macabre tales as The Telltale Heart and The Cask of Amontillado and The Fall of the House of Usher. And of course, who can think of Edgar Allan Poe without thinking of his poem, The Raven? On the Journey Into podcast, I've had an annual Edgar Allan Poe month where I feature his tales as well as stories inspired by his work. This year, I wanted to do something really special. Something I've always wanted to do is to commission a professional author to write a Poe-inspired tale. At the top of my wish list was author Ken Scholes. Ken is the award-winning and critically acclaimed author of over 40 short stories and 4 novels in his 5-book Psalms of Isaac series. I've enjoyed Ken's work for many years, and when I asked him if he'd be willing to write an Edgar Allan Poe story, he was all in. But I think Ken deserves to be paid professional rates for his work. And the only way for me to do that is to start a Kickstarter. And so if you go over to kickstarter.com and do a search for Poe Meets Ken, you should find it there. You can take a look at the different donation options and the extra rewards that I've offered. It's a comparatively small goal of $560. So please check out this project, and if it's something you think you'd like, contribute however much you would like. If we're successful, Ken will write his story, and then I'll produce it as a full cast audio production. Thanks for listening, and journey on!
The unknown.
Mystery.
Space.
Science!
Have fun.
Adventure.
Suspense.
Fantasy.
Nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror.
Welcome to Journey 108 of the Journey Into podcast, featuring The Maltese Falcon, starring Humphrey Bogart. I'm your guide on this journey, Marshall Latham, coming to you from base camp in Turner, Oregon. I hope everybody's doing well this autumn. I really enjoyed this time of year just because it's the change of seasons, and it's felt more abruptly, I think, than other seasons. At least in my experience here in the Northwest United States. Here in Oregon, the winters aren't as cold and we don't get as much snow and stuff, but definitely the weather changes, the leaves start to change colors, and it just this time of year always sparks good memories. To me, it just seems like a peaceful, restful time of the year. You know, even though I've slowed down a little bit on the podcast, this time of year makes me want to produce more stories. And to provide more old-time radio stuff, and I have a couple fun stories to feature for October. But I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself. We have today's story, which is a classic American film, The Maltese Falcon. And it's really one of Humphrey Bogart's biggest hits. Of course, not as big quite as Casablanca, but it was really the movie that speared him into superstardom. He became a leading man earlier than that, but this is really the movie where he really started to take charge as a superstar. And then, of course, Casablanca just kind of cemented that for him and imprinted him into the Hollywood elite, I guess you could say. And, you know, I enjoy his style, and I'll talk a little bit more about the movies after we finish our journey here. But a little bit about Humphrey Bogart. He was born on Christmas Day in 1899.
He was born in Watkins Glen in New York. He grew up going to private schools, but really didn't take to school that well. He really didn't like it. eventually, you know, was taken out of or expelled from Yale, depending on the stories that you listen to or want to believe. But later on, he joined the Navy, and after coming out of the Navy, he came back, and one of the jobs that he got was working at a film company called World Films. And the more he worked there, he got interested in screenwriting and directing and doing various things. He also started to do some acting in stage plays. Acting in the stage plays eventually led to him acting in films. And one of his good buddies at the time was Spencer Tracy. You know, they were kind of both up-and-coming actors or whatever. And they had a good friendship. Supposedly it was Spencer Tracy who first nicknamed Humphrey Bogart Bogey. You know, eventually he was just kind of a character actor, played more kind of villainous roles, mobster kind of things. But eventually he was able to move into starring roles. I guess Love Affair, a film in 1932, was the first time he starred as in the leading role. And he continued to do that until, like I said, he got to this movie, which is The Maltese Falcon, where he really started to jet forward in his career, followed up by Casablanca, and that led to, as I said, his iconic status in Hollywood, and had many, many leading roles after that. And so, but it all started here. It all started with The Maltese Falcon. This particular adaptation of The Maltese Falcon aired on the Academy Award Theater radio show. So the series ran from March of 1946 to December of 1946. And it's interesting, you know, by the title, Academy Award Theater, you would think they would be doing adaptations of all Oscar-nominated or Oscar Award-winning movies. But actually, it's kind of interesting. The rule was that any drama could be presented, whether it was a film or a play or whatever, but it had to have the cast had to include at least one Oscar-nominated performer in it. And not necessarily the same actor that played the role in the movie. However, as in the case of this one, they were able to get the original actor into the film, or into the adaptation. I found a couple other adaptations of The Maltese Falcon, but this one has Humphrey Bogart in it, and it really isn't The Maltese Falcon, in my opinion, without Humphrey Bogart. But it's probably time for me to stop talking about it, and time for us to get on our way. So come with me, and let's journey into the office of Private Detective Sam Spade in the city of San Francisco.
To the Falcon Car! Fasten seatbelts, Dog Wonder! Blue Falcon!
Dog Wonder!
Away!
Oiga, señor. We are federales. You know, the mountain police.
If you're the police, where are your badges?
Badges? We ain't got no badges. We don't need no badges. I don't have to show you any stinking badges.
Better not come any closer.
Han Solo. I'm Captain of the Millennium Falcon. Chewie here tells me you're looking for passage to the Alderaan system.
Yes, indeed. If it's a fast ship.
Fast ship? You've never heard of the Millennium Falcon?
Should I have?
It's a ship that made the Kessel Run in less than 12 parsecs. I've outrun Imperial starships. Not the local bulk cruisers, mind you. I'm talking about the big Carillion ships now. She's fast enough for you, old man. What's the cargo?
Only passengers. Myself, the boy, two droids, and no questions asked.
It's the stuff that dreams are made of. It's the slow and steady fire.
Sam Wilson.
Steve Rogers.
I kind of put that together.
Play it once, Sam. For all time's sake.
I don't know what you mean, Miss Elsa.
Play it, Sam. Play as time goes by.
Oh, I can't remember it, Miss Elsa. I'm a little rusty on it.
I'll hum it for you. Sing it, Sam.
You must remember this. A kiss is just a kiss. A sigh is just a sigh. The fundamental things apply as time goes by.
House of Squibb presents Academy Award. Every week, Squibb brings you Hollywood's finest. The great picture plays, the great actors and actresses. Techniques and skills chosen from the honor roll of those who have won or been nominated for the famous Golden Oscar of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. And now, E.R. Squibb and Sons, manufacturing chemist to the medical profession since 1858, bring you the distinguished star, Mr. Humphrey Bogart, who as Best Actor of the Year was nominated for the 1943 Academy Award. You will also hear Miss Mary Astor, who won the 1941 Academy Award as Best Supporting Actress of the Year, and Sidney Greenstreet, who was nominated for the 1941 Academy Award as Best Supporting Actor. Tonight, Mr. Bogart, Miss Astor, and Mr. Greenstreet will play the famous roles they created for the screen in The Maltese Falcon, the thrilling mystery which was nominated as Best Production of the Year for the 1941 Academy Award.
My name is Spade, Sam Spade. License number 357896, issued for the Police Department of San Francisco. Occupation, private detective, sometimes known as Private Eye. My files in the case of the Maltese Falcon are closed, but I've got the Maltese Falcon. I got it and some dough. My partner got murdered and a very slick chick went up for life. I'll tell you about it. This slick dame comes to see me one day, gives me a song and dance about her sister and a guy called Floyd Thursby. She wants her to get her sister back before her mother and father get in from Hawaii. I put my partner, Miles Archer, on the case. At night, he gets murdered. And so does this guy, Thursby. I go around to the apartment where the dame is living, the one called Bridget O'Shaughnessy. She had something I seemed to go for.
Oh, Mr. Spade, come in.
I have come in.
Oh, yes, so you have. Mr. Spade, am I to blame for last night?
You warned us that Thursby was dangerous. Of course, you lied to us about your sister and all that, but that doesn't count. We didn't believe you.
Oh, help me, Mr. Spade. I need help so badly. I've no right to ask you, but I do ask you. Help me.
You won't need much of anybody's help. You're good. You're awful good. It's chiefly your eyes, I think, and that throb you get into your voice when you say things like, help me, Mr. Spade.
I deserve that. But, oh, the lie was in the way I said it, and not at all in what I said.
If I'm going to help you, I've got to have some sort of a line on your Floyd Thursby.
I met him in the Orient. We came here from Hong Kong last week.
Did he kill Archer?
Yes, certainly.
Picked a nice sort of playmate.
Only that sort could have helped me if he had been loyal.
How bad a hole are you actually in?
As bad as could be.
Physical danger?
Well, I'm not heroic. I don't think there's anything worse than death.
Then it's that.
It's that as surely as we're sitting here. Unless you help me.
Who killed Thursby? Your enemies or his?
I don't know. His, I suppose. I'm afraid. I don't know.
Who are these enemies?
Well, there's a small, dark man with white teeth and a smooth, dangerous, fat man.
Oh, this is hopeless. Well, how much money have you got?
I have about $500 left.
Give it to me. There's only $400 here.
I had to keep some to live on.
Okay. I'll be back as soon as I can. You needn't come to the door with me. I can let myself out. I went by the office then and found a dark little guy with very white teeth waiting for me. His name was Joel Cairo. He was a Greek.
Mr. Spade, I'm trying to recover an ornament that has been, shall we say, mislaid. I thought and hoped you could assist me.
Uh-huh.
The ornament is a statuette. The black figure of a bird. I'm prepared to pay the sum of $5,000 for its recovery, and no questions asked.
$5,000's a lot of money. It's a very interesting figure.
You will put your hands together at the back of your neck, Mr. Spade.
Huh? Oh, sure.
I shall shoot you if you try to stop me, Mr. Spade. But I must search your office.
Well, you won't find anything but a pair of worn-out rubbers, a half pint of rum, and a pack of chewing gum.
We shall see. Please stand up. So.
Sure. This way?
No, the other way.
Sure. I'll take the gun, Mr. Cairo. Now get up.
I am very slow in things like that, unfortunately.
Yeah.
I'm still prepared to pay $5,000 for the return of the figure. Do you have it, Mr. Spade?
No.
If it is not here, why did you just risk serious injury to prevent my searching for it?
Well, I should sit around and let people come in and stick me up.
You wish some assurance of my sincerity? A retainer?
I might.
Say, $100?
You better make it $200. Thanks. Your first guess was that I had the bird. What's your second guess?
That you know where it is, or where you can get it.
Now, you're not hiring me to murder or do burglary, but to get back the figure in some lawful way. Say, from a dame with red hair, or a smooth, dangerous fat man.
Oh, so you know. You must beware of them. They would stop at nothing. May I have my pistol now?
Oh, yeah, sure. I'd forgotten it.
Thank you. Now, Mr. Spade, you will kindly clasp your hands behind your neck.
What the?
Don't move, Mr. Spade. This time I might shoot. I insist on searching your office.
Sure. Go ahead. I finally got rid of the Greek and started back for Bridges' apartment. Matter of fact, I had a hunch that the Greek was going there himself and started to tail his cab when a sad-faced guy poked something into my back and said...
Come on. The fat man wants to see you. Here he is, Mr. Gutman. The guy who was talking to the dame in the Greek.
Oh, Mr. Spade.
Mr. Gutman?
We begin well, sir. I distrust the man who talks too much.
I like to talk.
Of course, talking's something you can't do judiciously unless you keep in practice.
Yeah.
Now, sir, we'll talk if you like. And I'll tell you right out that I'm a man who likes talking to a man who likes to talk.
Swell. Will we talk about the blackbird?
You're the man for me, sir. No beating about the bush, right to the point. Let us talk about the blackbird by all means. Mr. Spade, have you any conception of how much money can be got for that blackbird?
No.
Well, sir, if I told you half, you'd call me a liar.
No, not even if I thought so. But you just tell me what it is, and I'll figure out the profits.
You mean you don't know what that bird is?
Well, I know what it's supposed to look like. I know the value in human life you people put on it.
So Shaughnessy didn't tell you what it is? And Cairo didn't either?
He offered me $10,000 for it.
$10,000? And dollars, mind you, not even pounds. They must know what it is. Or do they? What is your impression?
I can't tell. They're both lying.
If they don't know, I'm the only one in the whole wide, sweet world who does.
Swell. When you've told me, that'll make two of us.
Mathematically correct, sir. But I don't know for certain that I'm going to tell you.
Oh, don't be foolish. You know what it is, I know where it is. That's why I'm here.
Well, sir, where is it?
Don't be silly.
You see, I must tell you what I know, but you will not tell me what you know. That is hardly equitable, sir. No. I don't think we can do business along those lines.
Yeah, well, think again and think fast. I can get along without you, and keep that gunsel away from me while you're making up your mind. I'll kill him.
Well, sir, I must say you're the most violent temper.
Well, what are you wasting time for? You've got till 5:30. Then you're either in or out for keeps. three characters and a black bird. Well, all I knew was my partner was dead and the cops were getting very uncooperative about the whole thing, including who killed Floyd Thursby. I thought I'd better get back to see that O'Shaughnessy dame before it was too late. And sure enough, it almost was.
They came here and took him away.
Took who away? Who?
The police. They wanted to talk to you, too. They took Mr. Cairo with them.
What was he doing here?
He came to talk about the bird.
What is this bird, this falcon that everybody's all steamed up about?
Suppose I wouldn't tell you anything at all about it. What would you do? Something wild and unpredictable?
Maybe.
Well, it's a black figure, as you know. Smooth and shiny of a bird, a hawk or falcon about 12 inches high.
Now, what makes it so important?
I don't know. They wouldn't tell me. But they promised me £500 if I helped them get it from the man who had it.
Go ahead.
They promised me £500 to help them, and I did. Then we found that Joel Cairo was going to take the falcon and desert Floyd and me, so we did that to Joel first.
You are a liar.
I am a liar. I've always been a liar.
Well, don't brag about it. Was there any truth at all in that yarn?
Some. Not very much.
Well, we've got plenty of time. I'll put some coffee on and we'll try again.
Oh, I'm so tired. So tired of lying and thinking up lies and not knowing what is a lie and what is the truth. Oh, darling, don't stare at me like that. Come closer, darling.
It is something to do while waiting. Why not?
Kiss me, Sam Spade. Kiss me.
Why not? That happens every time. I'll get it.
Be careful, darling.
Okay. Come on, you. He wants to see you.
Well, if it isn't the fat man's killer. Hello, pale face. How many did you bump off today?
Shut up. Cupman's waiting for you.
No kidding. What kept you?
Darling, what does he want?
He wants me. The fat man's been thinking things over.
Well, Mr. Spade, I must apologize for sending for you in this fashion.
Now, never mind. Let's talk about the bird.
All right, let's. What do you think of the order of the Hospital of St. John of Jerusalem?
Crusaders or something, weren't they?
Very good. In 1539, these crusading knights persuaded Emperor Charles V to give them the island of Malta. He made but one condition. They were to pay him each year the tribute of a falcon in acknowledgement that Malta was still under Spain. Do you follow me?
Yeah.
Have you any conception of the extreme, immeasurable wealth of the order of that time?
Well, I imagine they were pretty well fixed.
They were rolling in wealth, sir. They hit upon the happy thought of sending the emperor for the first year's tribute, not an insignificant live bird, but a glorious golden falcon, encrusted from head to foot with the finest jewels in their coffers. Allow me to replenish your drink, sir. Well, what do you think of these knights?
I don't know.
Well, sir, the glorious falcon never reached Spain. Buccaneers raided the galleon. In 1713, the bird showed up in Sicily. In 1840, in Paris. And it had by that time acquired a coat of black enamel, looking like nothing but a fairly interesting black statue. In 1923, a Greek dealer found it in an obscure Paris shop. He knew what it was. I heard about it in London and rushed over to buy it. But the Greek was murdered and the falcon gone. That was 23 years ago. For 23 years, I've searched for the bird. I traced it to the home of a Russian general, Kemedov, but he wouldn't sell, even though he knew nothing of its value. I was forced to send my agents after it. They got it, sir, but I haven't got it. But I'm going to get it, sir. How soon are you willing to produce the falcon?
A couple of days.
That is satisfactory. Well, sir, here's a fair bargain and profits large enough for both of us.
What's your idea of a fair bargain?
Shall I say 100,000?
Why not?
What did you say to a quarter of a million?
Oh, then you think the dingus is worth a million, no?
Why not?
Yeah, why not? Hey, I feel kind of funny, Gutman. That drink.
My dear man, how could you suggest anything so cruel?
I...
Wilma.
Yeah. The drink got him, huh?
Put your guns away, Wilma. You must learn to be subtle in these things, like me.
Hot like a light, huh? Well, I owe him something, the louse. He thinks he's tough. Let's see if he can take this.
That's enough, Wilma. You kicked him enough. It would never do to kill him here. Besides, Wilma, you know how I hate the sight of blood.
I guess the name of Sam Spade was a cinch for the back page obituaries, but I came out of it somehow and managed to get up and stagger out of that apartment. I went around to the hotel where Joel Cairo had a room and made a deal with a house dick to let me search it. All I could find was a newspaper in the wastebasket folded back to the steamship news. There was a list of arrivals and one was marked. It said, 8:07 a.m., the La Paloma from Hong Kong. That was good enough for me. I got a cab and rode down to the docks. The La Paloma was on fire and burning beautifully. I went back to my office to hold my aching head and think things over when the door opened. A tall guy in a long black overcoat stood there with a package in his hands, making gurgling noises before he fell like a tree. He should have. He was dead. I took a good look at him. He was the mate off the La Paloma. I unwrapped his package, and there it was. The black bird. The Maltese falcon. I grabbed the phone and listened. It was Bridget O'Shaughnessy, and she said she was in trouble. I found her shivering in a dark corner of an office building. I took her and the falcon home to my apartment. I put her on the couch. I put the falcon in the icebox where no one would think to look for anything, including ice. I came back in and switched on the lights and found a surprise party waiting to greet me.
Well, sir, we're all here. Now let's sit down and be comfortable and talk.
Sure. Get away from me, Gunchel. You're not going to frisk me.
Stand still.
Shut up. Put your paw on me, and I'm going to make you use that gun. Ask your boss if he wants me shut up before we talk.
Never mind, Wilma. You're certainly a most headstrong individual, Mr. Spade. Well, let's be seated.
You too, Cairo. You can put down your gun, too.
Of course, Mr. Spade. I was only using caution, as it were.
You ready, Gutman? Are you ready to make the first payment and take the falcon off my hands?
Well, sir, as to that, here are $10,000, sir.
Oh, we were talking about more money than this.
Yes, sir, we were. But this is genuine coin of the realm, sir. With a dollar of this, you can buy $10 of talk. Besides, there are more of us that'd be taken care of now.
Well, that may be, but I've got the falcon.
I should not think it would be necessary to remind you, Mr. Spade, that though you may have the falcon, yet we certainly have you.
Yes, I'm trying not to let that worry me. We'll come to the money later. There's another thing to be taken care of first. We've got to have a fall guy. The police have to have a victim. Somebody they can stick for those three murders.
Two. Only two murders, Mr. Spade. Thursby undoubtedly killed your partner.
All right, two. What difference does it make? The point is, we've got to give the police...
Come, Mr. Spade. You can't expect us to believe at this late date. You are the least afraid of the police, or that you're not able to handle...
I'm up to my neck, Gutman. I've got to come through with somebody, a victim, when the time comes. If I don't, I'll be it. Let's give him the gun, Silly. Actually, he did shoot Thursby and the other one, didn't he? Anyway, he's made to order for the part. Let's turn him over to the cops.
Get up on your feet. I've taken all the riding from you I'm going to take. Get up, shoot it out.
No, no, Wilma, don't shoot.
There, Gunsel, that'll take care of you. Put him on the sofa. Sorry, Bridget, but you seem to have recovered.
I'm all right.
Good. Well, gentlemen, there's our fall guy. And now, gentlemen, you agree or I'll turn the falcon and the whole lot of you in.
Mr. Spade, I don't like this. What if we took matters into our own hands and killed you?
You won't, or you'll never find the falcon.
True, but there are other ways we could make you talk.
No, I'd take it and make you kill me, and then you'd end up the same way.
No, I believe you would, too.
Well?
I've always felt toward Wilma like a father. But you can have him.
Swell, let's get the details fixed. Why did he shoot Thursby?
Thursby was Miss O'Shaughnessy's ally. We thought in disposing of him, we would teach Miss O'Shaughnessy to patch up her differences with us regarding the falcon.
And the mate from the La Paloma.
That was Miss O'Shaughnessy's fault. Cairo got in touch with me when he saw the notice of the ship's arrival. He remembered that the mate and Miss O'Shaughnessy had been friendly in Hong Kong. He called on this man, but he, with Miss O'Shaughnessy and the bird, slipped through our fingers. We followed them to her apartment, and Wilma shot the mate as he was coming down the fire escape. He shot him many times, but the man was tough, and he did not drop the falcon. We persuaded Miss O'Shaughnessy to call your office, but unfortunately she did not call in time to prevent you from meeting the mate and getting the falcon.
I see.
And now, sir, would it be presumptuous if we asked to see the Falcon?
Okay. It's in my icebox.
Icebox, I see. You are a character, sir. Yes, very, very clever of you. Very.
I've got it. I've got it.
Bring it in here at once.
Here. Wrapped in this.
Now, after 23 years, it is it. We'll make sure. Hand me your knife, sir.
Here.
I'll peel off some of this disfiguring enamel. It's a fake.
All right, O'Shaughnessy, you've had your little joke. Now tell us about
it. No, Sam, no. That's the one I got from the Russian, I swear.
You bungled it, Gutman. You and your stupid attempt to buy it. The Russian caught on how valuable it was. No wonder we had so little trouble stealing it. You imbecile. You bloated idiot.
Yes. This is the Russian's hand. There's no doubt of it. Well, sir, what do you suggest? Shall we stand here and shed tears and call each other names? Or shall we go to Istanbul and interview our Russian friend?
Go to Istanbul?
For 23 years, I have wanted that little item and have been trying to get it. If I must spend another year on the quest, well, that will be an added expenditure in time only.
I go with you. Wilma's gone.
Wilma's gone. So he has. That makes it imperative that we go, too. Oh, by the way, sir, I'll trouble you for my envelope containing the $10,000.
I kept my end of the bargain, but I'll settle for $1,000 for expenses.
Thank you. I'll allow you the $1,000.
That'll take care of my time.
Now, sir, we'll say goodbye to you unless you care to undertake the Istanbul expedition with us. You don't? That's too bad. Well, sir, the shortest farewells are best. Adieu. And to you, Miss O'Shaughnessy, I leave the rare Avis there on the table as a little memento. The Maltese Falcon.
O'Shaughnessy, talk.
Where shall I begin?
You came to me and asked me to have Thursby followed. I put my partner on it. He followed Thursby. He was killed. You must have told Thursby he was being followed.
I told him, yes, but please believe me, Sam. I wouldn't have told him if I'd thought Floyd Thursby would kill your partner.
Miles hadn't many brains, but he had too many years' experience as a detective to be caught like that by a man he was shadowing up a blind alley with his gun tucked away in his hip and his overcoat buttoned. But he'd have gone up there with you, Angel. He was just dumb enough for that. And then you could have stood as close to him in the dark as you liked and put a bullet through him.
Don't talk like that to me, Sam. You know I didn't
Stop
know...
Stop it. Why did you shoot him?
I didn't mean to at first. I can't look at you and tell you this,
You thought Thursby would tackle him. If he got Thursby, then you were rid of him. If Thursby won, you had something on him. Enough to be rid of him for good. Wasn't that it?
Something like that.
But when Thursby backed down, you took the gun and did the job yourself.
Oh, Sam, sweetheart, from the very first instant I saw you, I knew...
You angel... Well, if you get a good break, you'll be out of San Quentin in 20 years, and you can come back to me then. I hope they don't hang you, Precious, by that sweet neck.
You know deep down in your heart that in spite of anything I've done, I love you.
I don't care who loves who. I'm not going to play the sap for you. I won't walk in Thursby's and I don't know how many others' footsteps. You killed my partner, and you're going over for it.
Why must you do this to me, Sam? Surely your partner wasn't as much to you
as... Listen, listen to me. This won't do any good. You'll never understand me, but I'll try once and then give it up. Listen, when a man's partner is killed, he's supposed to do something about it. And it happens we're in the detective business. Well, when one of your organization gets killed, it's bad business to let the killer get away with it. Bad all around. Bad for every detective everywhere.
You can't send me to the... Sam, you can't. You love me. You love me.
Maybe I do. What of it? Maybe next month I won't. I've been through it before. I'll have some rotten nights after I've sent you over, but that'll pass. I want you, sure, but I won't take you at the price because all of me wants to, regardless of consequences. Because you counted on that with me the same as you counted on that with all the others.
Sam, darling, kiss me, kiss me.
Sure. Sure, baby.
What are you doing? Who are you calling?
The cops, baby. The cops to come and take you away.
This is Hugh Grundy, bidding you good night until next Wednesday at the same time. when you're invited to listen again to Academy Award, presented by the House of Squibb, a name you can trust. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
So there you go. There's the Maltese Falcon. And I remember hearing about this movie and you know, heard many of the lines quoted and whatnot.
One of the things that I missed in listening to the radio adaptation of this was that he didn't utter his classic line that he does at the end of the movie, where, regarding the Maltese Falcon, he says,
The stuff that dreams are made of.
Huh? But I guess you have to cut things out when you're making it shorter for the radio. Before I talk about Humphrey Bogart and his movies and things like that, I wanted to make you aware of a really cool, fun audio drama that's going on right now at HiddenHarborMysteries.com. And this is a old-time radio type production. Brian Lincoln has done all the production on this and cast many great voice actors in the roles, many that you're familiar with. Dave Robison, Rish Outfield, Norm Sherman, Veronica Jaguer, Lauren Scribe Harris, and on and on and on. So go to HiddenHarborMysteries.com and check out this audio production. There's already 3 episodes of it out, so you can get started on it. And it's a lot of fun. You know, it's produced in the style of the type of shows that I run, the old-time radio shows that I run here on the podcast. It's got the organ music that starts it out. It's got the commercials for the cigarettes. It's got the over-the-top narration. And it's got, you know, the great feel of an old-time radio show audio drama. It's kind of a superhero type story. In fact, here's a trailer for it, so you can get a feel for this story.
Brian Lincoln Productions presents an exciting new audio drama, Hidden Harbor Mysteries.
Hidden Harbor is a city of light beset by darkness.
One of my girls, what works the streets, says there's an army of women.
Barbara Wilson uses her mystical powers to defend the innocent.
Give me strength to continue my pursuit of those who've done evil in this city.
While others scheme in the shadows to destroy her.
Femme Phantom, they call you. You're out there somewhere, and I will have you.
Valiant heroes.
I'm used to making deals with the devil, but this is a first time.
Black-hearted villains.
I expect you will be difficult to break.
Pulse-pounding action. As the forces for good battle the architects of evil.
Confounded, Barbara, I knew something like this would happen. You went in without thinking.
We are bound by heavy chains. A simple leash can feel like freedom.
Hidden Harbor Mysteries is written by Jay Smith and produced by Brian Lincoln. Find out more at HiddenHarborMysteries.com.
Oh yeah, I did forget to mention that this was written by Jay Smith. He's written a lot of the HD World stuff that Brian Lincoln has been involved with producing as well. But anyway, check this out. It's a lot of fun. I really enjoy listening to it, not only because I know Brian and I know the quality of the production that he does, but it's just it's a fun story, and it's produced really well. And if you like the old-time radio shows that I play, like The Maltese Falcon, you'll really enjoy listening to this audio drama. So check that out. Okay, back to Humphrey Bogart. Regarding The Maltese Falcon,
I remember sitting down and actually watching the movie, and I totally loved it. I totally got into it. I enjoyed the whole cynical private detective, hard-boiled detective, and this is really where it came from. This wasn't the first type of movie like this, but it kind of epitomizes the hard-boiled detective type of movie, the film noir. And this and Casablanca really did set up Humphrey Bogart to his iconic status. And, you know, you could say that the guy's been typecast into that role, But I think it served him well. You know, even though he might not have been had a lot of versatile roles and opportunities to stretch in his career, I think you could find examples of that. There's one example that I can think of. But what I thought I'd do, one thing I realized as I went through his filmography is that I really haven't watched a lot of Humphrey Bogart movies. I thought I had, but I guess I haven't. Really just some of those movies that everybody's heard about, like The Maltese Falcon, Casablanca. But I thought I'd kind of go through these movies that I know about and talk about them a little bit. And of course, you know, he made many, many movies. You know, Hollywood was a little bit different at that time. You know, the actors were under contract to make movies, and so they jumped from role to role to role, and they didn't necessarily pick everything they wanted to do. But in 1941, you know, there were four movies that came out in 1941 that Humphrey Bogart was a part of. There was High Sierra, there was The Wagons Roll at Night, The Maltese Falcon, and All Through the Night. And, you know, that's a lot of movies. But at that time, they kind of cranked through movies in Hollywood, and they kind of, you know, there were definitely ones, top-billed movies, and probably movies that were just made so the studio or whatever could get movies out and they could make money, similar to today, but I think they cranked them out at a little bit faster rate back then, at least it seems they did. And these actors were used, and they weren't, even though Humphrey Bogart became this great icon and probably was able to pick some of his roles later on, you know, he was just part of the movie mill, you know, just an actor on the docket. And as he became more and more famous, of course, he became more and more in demand. But, you know, again, I'm speaking like I'm an authority on this, and I know a lot. I could probably do a lot more studying. Anyway, so I've seen The Maltese Falcon. We just heard the 30-minute adaptation of the movie. Again, I'm not going to go over the same thing over and over again, but, you know, it does have everything you think of when you think of this type of a hard-boiled detective movie. But it's really quite interesting. Alfred Hitchcock kind of penned the term MacGuffin. And, you know, this movie is totally built around the MacGuffin of The Maltese Falcon. What is it? Why do they want it? And that's just kind of fun. That's what drives the plot. That's what drives the mystery of what's going on. And really, that mystery is never answered. I mean, we learn what the Maltese Falcon is and kind of its origins, where it came from, and why it's so wanted, because of, you know, it's got all these jewels and all these things, so it's of a lot of value, but there's not a big resolution to it at the end. And I like that. You know, I like that the mystery is out there. Who has the Maltese Falcon? Where is it? That kind of thing. But you have these, you know, you have this woman that comes to his office, and the mystery of how much does she really know about it. That's always a fun part of this type of a story. But then you have the Russian, and you have all these other things, and his partner was killed. And there's just all these things, and you're kind of in the same boat as Sam Spade, where you don't know what's going on. But he's the one that's bold. He's the one that figures out and kind of plays everybody and figures everything out by the end, even more than the police. And, you know, we know as much as he does, so we're able to learn as he learns. And that I enjoy that. And I just enjoy all the acting and just the way this whole thing was set.
Some other movies of Humphrey Bogart of note, I guess, or ones that I know a little bit about. The next year, as I've said, was Casablanca, one of the most famous movies of all time. Another movie that I haven't seen, but I learned that To Have and To Have Not, which was in 1944, was the first time he ever starred with Lauren Bacall, who then later on became his wife. And he was in several movies with her. The Big Sleep, which I haven't seen, but I've heard a lot of good things about. And Dark Passage, Key Largo, those are the ones that he was in with Lauren Bacall. And it's interesting, she was either 18 or 19 when they got married, and he was like 44. The next movie up that I recognize is The Treasure of Sierra Madre. And I really liked him in that movie. It was kind of a different role. It was set in Mexico, when him and a couple other guys were prospectors looking for gold, and it's all about their greed and their possessiveness and what they're willing to do to get the gold, and just kind of a departure from the detective type role that he usually has. And I really like that one. If you noticed, as the Wamperdine was dialing in to the radio program, it ran across the oft-quoted badges quote from the Treasure of Sierra Madre. Badges? We don't need no badges. We don't have to show you any stinking badges. It's a fun quote. And then the next one, which I've seen part of this movie. It's another one of his classics. The African Queen that he was in with Katharine Hepburn. Now, The African Queen was in 1951. I think the last two movies that I've seen of his were both in 1954. The first one is The Caine Mutiny. And that might be my favorite movie of his. Just overall, I think the movie is a good one. He plays Lieutenant Commander Philip Francis Queeg in that one. And he's this lieutenant commander of a ship. And he's been in war a long time, and he's an older commander in the Navy. And the crew watches him kind of break down under pressure and act strangely and have obsessions about things. And it's kind of about their experience with him. And what do they do? Do they mutiny? Do they... At one point, he becomes obsessed that somebody ate the strawberries that were set aside for all of the officers. And he's convinced that somebody from the cooking staff, I think, has stolen it or eaten the strawberries. And he does a massive check of the ship, and everybody has to do all this stuff based on his obsession over these strawberries. And that's just one of the things. And he's just acting erratically and irrationally at times. And, of course, at the end, there's a trial and a court-martial, and Humphrey Bogart as Commander Queeg goes up to be testifying. And it's almost, you know, and for that time, you know, it's kind of like a you can't handle the truth moment. You know, it's not quite as dramatic as what you get in A Few Good Men, because this was in the 1950s and things were a little bit different. The way people acted and the way things were directed and done. So it's not quite as dramatic as that. But there's a lot of behind the scenes and a lot about the character of all the different officers involved. And it's a good movie all around. And Humphrey Bogart does a great job at playing this role. And I believe, you know, I was talking about before how he probably didn't get to pick a lot of his roles in his younger career. He just had to make the next movie, whatever movie they told him, he had to go to it. This is probably late enough in his career where he could pick these roles, or these roles would come to him and he'd have his pick on what he wanted to do. I'm not sure. I'm not an expert on how Hollywood works throughout the decades. But anyway, I thought that was one of his best roles and a really good movie. On the other hand, I think Sabrina, where he plays Linus Larrabee, is probably the movie I liked him in least. And it's probably because I was spoiled by the Sabrina movie where Harrison Ford played Linus Larrabee. I think it was 1994, 95 maybe, when that movie came out. And I love that movie. I just liked the characters in it. I like the romance of it. I took several dates into that movie. My wife and I watched it when we were dating. I think it was out on DVD at that point, but I really liked that movie. I liked, is it Julia Ormond was the lead actress in that, and you had Harrison Ford playing Linus Larrabee, and you had Greg Kinnear as his younger brother, David Larrabee. And again, I liked that movie enough. And then I heard that it was based on on an older movie from the 1950s starring Humphrey Bogart, and I'm like, well, that's got to be good. And I watched that movie and I was not impressed. I didn't like the acting from anybody. I thought it was kind of cheesy in a lot of ways. And it's just probably sensibility of a modern type film versus a film from back then. If I'm going into a movie and I haven't seen a remake of it, you know, I go in, okay, yep, this is a 1940s movie, this is a 1950s movie, and I kind of get into that mode and I excuse a lot of the way things were done back then that are, you know, not quite what we would appreciate today. You know, something like It's a Wonderful Life. I mean, I love that movie and I watch it every year at least. And I like all the performances in it, but there are some really corny, Corny's not necessarily a bad thing, but just acting or the way, you know, the script is, or it's just kind of weird and awkward in places. But I overlook those things because that's just the way movies were made. You know, they have quick cuts and they have some strange dialogue, and at least in terms of what we expect. So, but with Sabrina, I wasn't in that mode. I was comparing it to the movie with Harrison Ford and found it lacking quite a bit. I mean, the whole, like, instead of going off to Paris to be involved in modeling and photography and all that, Sabrina goes off to cooking school. And that whole sequence where she's at cooking school is just really cheesy and really weird. And then I just don't buy the romance in that movie. And romance is kind of a strange thing in movies from the 1940s and 50s too. It's kind of a forced romance. This is supposed to be romantic. The music is telling me that. And I'm supposed to feel that these people are connected. Sometimes it works. You can really get that sometimes. But in Sabrina, at least for me, it didn't work in the Humphrey Bogart movie. But that got me thinking about Humphrey Bogart and what an iconic person he was, iconic actor. You know, who is the Humphrey Bogart of today? And I guess that Sabrina connection kept coming back to me, because when I think about actors of today, really Harrison Ford fills that role of being the Humphrey Bogart of the last 3 decades or more. You know, if you go all the way back to something like Blade Runner, which is a noir type movie, even though it's in the future and it's science fiction, it's a very gritty, almost hard-boiled detective type of a movie with some science fiction elements to it. And to be honest, that's not one of my favorite movies. I know among science fiction fans that might be blasphemous. Some people look at Blade Runner as like one of the best science fiction movies ever. I thought it was a good film, and I really enjoyed Harrison Ford in it. But after I saw it the first time, it really didn't do a lot for me to go back and watch it again and again. That's just not that type of a movie for me. But that role that Harrison Ford had in that movie is very reminiscent of a Humphrey Bogart type role. Even something like Witness is kind of that same thing. And if you go into his other characters, you know, what's his most famous role, right? Han Solo. Han Solo is a very, especially in the first movie, Star Wars, it's a very roguish, and he's kind of a cynical person, much like Humphrey Bogart's characters are the cynical person in the movie. And so I really get that feeling from Han Solo. And I've enjoyed Harrison Ford in most of the roles he's had. Not every movie that he's in, but he really is an iconic actor of today and would fill for me that role of Humphrey Bogart back in the 40s and 50s. And so that led me thinking down a different route. You know, what if Humphrey Bogart had starred as Han Solo in Star Wars? How would he have played that role? How would that be? And then I started thinking, well, who else could we recast in Star Wars? Who could be Obi-Wan Kenobi, who would be an older type actor from maybe the 40s and 50s, where Humphrey Bogart was so famous. If Star Wars was made in the 1940s and 50s, who would be the roles that would play that? And the only person I could think of for Obi-Wan Kenobi is Ed Wynn. And if you don't know who Ed Wynn is from his name, you've definitely heard people riff on his voice. The most recent riff I heard on his voice was Wreck-It Ralph and the voice for King Candy.
My duds, it's Wreck-It Ralph.
Yeah? Who are you, the guy that makes the donuts?
Please, no, I'm King Candy.
I see you're a fan of pink.
Salmon, that's obviously salmon. What are you doing here?
Look, your candiness, this is just a big misunderstanding. Just get me out of this cupcake, I'll get my medal, and I'll be out of your way.
Your medal? Bad guys don't win medals.
Well, this one did. I earned it over in Hero's Duty.
You game jumped? Ralph, you're not going turbo, are you?
What? No.
If you think you can come in here to my kingdom and take over my game, you've got another thing coming.
Easy, your puffiness.
It was a total imitation of Ed Wynn's voice and his cadence and just the way he talks. Oh, another movie that you'd probably remember him from is Mary Poppins. He was Uncle Albert in Mary Poppins. I love to laugh! Ha 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 ha! Long and loud! And he was Uncle Albert, and he was laughing and flying in the air with Dick Van Dyke in Mary Poppins. So that's probably the role you'd remember him most from. But he came from vaudeville, he did radio, he did television. And so I thought, okay, he's an older guy. Around that time, he would be perfect as Obi-Wan Kenobi. And Luke? Well, I don't know. Let me think of a scene from Star Wars.
Han Solo. I'm captain of the Millennium Falcon. Chewie here tells me you're looking for passage to the Alderaan system.
Yes, indeed. If it's a fast ship.
Fast ship? You've never heard of the Millennium Falcon.
Should I have?
It's the ship that dreams are made of. It made the Kessel Run in less than 12 parsecs. I've outrun Imperial starships. Not the local bulk cruisers, mind you. I'm talking about the big Carillion ships now. She's fast enough for you, old man. What's the cargo?
Only passengers. Myself, the boy, two droids, and no questions asked.
What is it? Some kind of local trouble?
Let's just say we'd like to avoid any Imperial entanglements.
Well, that's the trick, isn't it? And it's going to cost you something extra. 10,000. In advance.
10,000? We could almost buy our own ship for that.
But who's going to fly it, kid? You?
You bet I could. I'm not such a bad pilot myself. We don't have to sit here and listen.
We could pay you 2,000 now. Plus 15 when we reach Alderaan.
17, huh? Okay. You guys got yourself a ship. This could be the beginning of a beautiful friendship. We'll leave as soon as you're ready. Docking Bay 94.
94?
Yeah, I could see that working. That could work. I like that. Well, I think that's all I have for this episode. Just another quick reminder. Help me spread the word about the Edgar Allan Poe Meets Ken Scholes Kickstarter. You can go to the forums at journeyinto.freeforums.org. You can send me an email at journeyintopodcast@gmail.com. And of course, I'm on Facebook. Just look for Journey Into Podcast. I'm on Twitter under Journey Into. And I'll be back this month with some scary stories for you. some things I think you'll enjoy closer to Halloween. But until then, stay safe out there and journey on.
Hey, my name's Matt and I produce for Escape Pod, but I'm here to tell you that the Journey Into podcast is produced under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license, which basically means we want you to get out there and share it with everybody you can, but you cannot change it and you cannot charge money for it because you didn't make it. You don't deserve to charge money for it. Don't be a jerk. Don't charge. Anyway, the theme music for the podcast has been provided by Man in Space. Man in Space.